Hi. So my job is to sort of convince you, well, want to tell you why we went about this and this consultation that resulted in your presenters here, and why you should pay attention to the basic science aspects related to chlamydia control. It's not just esoterica, so to speak. So this was our title. That's who I am. And, you know, so this is the goals of where we are. You know, April 2008, we pulled together this expert advisory meeting that was addressing chlamydia immunology and looking specifically at the implications for control. And as a result of really a tremendous amount of work, the background papers that supported a lot of the meeting proceedings are going to be, and new updates, obviously, in terms of what's appeared in the literature, will be out a little later this year. The goals today are the same as the goals of the meeting and behind the special issue. And then with the following, we're really looking to highlight the key questions related to chlamydia natural history, the pathogenesis, the immunobiology that really were relevant specifically to the prevention of chlamydia and its sequelae. It wasn't just sort of things that are nice or interesting to know. And we also considered the extent to which these questions were and were not addressed by the existing data, and then likewise to identify what are the important gaps that really should be addressed by research. Now, I say, why care and why address this? Well, chlamydia prevention then and now really was facing multiple challenges and really have not been and are not a lot of easy answers to go around. I'm going to say this issue related to basic science aren't the only critical questions facing chlamydia, but they are at the heart of some of the issues that are being faced. Now, just to take a quick trip through memory lane, those of you may remember, this is a while ago. This is 1985. We got started with guidelines about chlamydia prevention and control, and some of the facts that were available then really sort of stood to some extent the test of time. Estimation at that point, 3 to 4 million cases a year, over $1 billion in costs. You needed control strategies to reduce morbidity. Rates were highest among females sexually active below 20 years of age. At that point, the focus was on treatment of what we say chlamydia-associated syndromes and not screening, because at that point, really didn't have available tests to allow screening to be done. A few years after that, 8 years after that, we had 1993 guidelines really talking a broader perspective of prevention for chlamydia that there came out with a national strategy. Numbers were about the same. Now it was community-based strategies and invoking the need for screening among asymptomatics. Screening criteria moved a little bit, but basically, you know, focusing in on women under 24 years of age. Same thing, not a whole lot of stuff has changed. Now, at that point in time, 1993, 94, when we came out with that thing, we were really riding pretty high. Those of you that remember what had gone on in Region 10, you were seeing positivity decline quite dramatically. We thought, you know, this was how it's supposed to be done, and we kind of expected this would be the way the future would look. Well, you know, it wasn't to be. This is median positivity by state, and you see what's happened. It's continued to increase, you know, every year. We had actually expected rates probably, it wasn't so clearly articulated, but at the time we were sort of putting together those guidelines, there was the expectation that chlamydia would follow the path laid out by gonorrhea, which, you know, in the mid-70s when it launched the gonorrhea prevention program, was followed by a monotonic and reasonably rapid decline in gonorrhea rates. Well, we know what's happened with chlamydia. You know, it's been a growth industry, right? And you know, we're making all kinds of excuses. Well, maybe it's test sensitivity, and maybe it's in populations change. Clearly, you know, and all these are valid. But nonetheless, we really would rather have seen that gonorrhea, the rate plummet like it did in gonorrhea. Now, meanwhile, you know, not expect to read all these, but I'll tell you kind of what's here. We've been hearing challenges from around the world about chlamydia prevention. Some folks across a whole series of countries, whether it's Norway, Finland, Canada, Sweden, saying, hey, our rates are up. Our rates are up, and we have to reconsider what we're doing. Others have said, you know what? You don't have enough evidence to justify your opportunistic screening approach. Others have said, how much infertility really is getting caused by chlamydia? Others have said, you know, you're overestimating, you know, the parameters used in your cost effectiveness models. That's what all this stuff is. And other people have said, you know, when you're treating, you're interrupting the development of protective immunity and actually increasing the risk of reinfection, and so that's driving some of your rates higher. So all of these things, you know, we're listening to this. By the way, those news is not as bad. You know, I think when you look actually at some of the data we have, true prevalence data, we are seeing some progress. You can't use case reports, you can't use positivity, but the impact is not robust. It's reasonably thin, and you have to look pretty hard. And so all these questions are really relevant, and we have to think through how to start dealing with some of this. So the bottom line is that public health in general, as with chlamydia prevention, really is facing multiple challenges. Budget constraints, the need to prove what you're doing, you know, is valid, you know, and that there's good solid evidence trail behind there. So it really is important to be going through and see and be convinced of the validity of the assumptions you're making. And really to review, we're sort of saying the information landscape from multiple perspectives, not from just the perspective that you're most comfortable with, and to be sure that we're taking advantage, I would say, of all the important information available. And with that in mind, to consider important and relevant issues, I would say from a basic science perspective, since it really was clear as we were talking through this, that public health practitioners, epidemiologists, clinicians, like a lot of us that work to set up that meeting, we're not very familiar with this literature, and it was a learning experience for a lot of us. So the focus of the meeting, as it will be here, was on pathogenesis, was on immunity, particularly, you know, given re-exposure, and clearance of infection. And one thing we won't be talking about, but is assumed, is the benefit of chlamydia screening. There have been a couple of randomized trials in Seattle and Denmark that have found 50% reduction in PID by 1 year after screening. Neither study is perfect. It's been identified in a series of articles and comments. Seattle study, as you see here, only 7% of the randomized women had been enrolled, and there was unequal sort of effort at contact and follow-up by arm. Danish study was also somewhat problematic. There was a recent study done, actually, out of England, you know, where they had randomized young London students to screening, they were screened, and whether it treated or not was almost at random, and they evaluated PID outcomes within the year, and they found the same findings as the Scholes and the other study from Denmark. So those observations really appear to hold up, but keep in mind, no trials have evaluated long-term outcomes such as infertility. So why care about the public science aspect of it? Well, there are three questions I raise and three scenarios that I think helps demonstrate why this is important. First, I'd say, when does tubal damage occur? Now, if tubal damage occurs soon after the acquisition of infection, then identifying and treating prevalent infection, meaning infection that's been hanging around a while, really won't help that infected individual very much. It would be more important then to have approaches that prevent new infection, incident infections, which means it would be emphasizing partner treatment, use of condoms, in addition to the case finding from screening. On the other hand, if it turns out damage occurs late, maybe months after infection is acquired, then the efforts really should be focusing on screening coverage, identifying and treating as many prevalent infections as possible. Second question. How effective is immunity in terms of protecting against re-exposure? And the corollary questions to that, so let's assume it's effective. How long does it take for that immunity to develop? And does treatment of infection significantly interfere with the development of effective immunity? So if immunity turns out not to be particularly effective, then obviously the issue of compromise by treatment is irrelevant. But if immunity is very protective, what does that mean? Well, you know, now it says, those individuals you have treated, you may be compromising them unless treatment is implemented so broadly that the risk of exposure has been lowered. Otherwise, you know, if the risk of exposure is the same and you're leaving them more susceptible, you may have not done them much good. So, and lastly, how harmful are repeat infections in terms of damage to reproductive health? So if repeat infections are disproportionately more damaging, meaning it's not just a matter of having more infections, but the risk per infection, the damage with per infection is greater with repeats, then program efforts really should be focusing on partner services, repeat screening, and condom use among those with a history of infection. But let's say it's not disproportionately greater. Well, then program activities really should be based on approaches that prevent the greater number of infections, right? Because it's not then more important to get a repeat infection prevented and treated than one that's not. Okay. Now, these are all very important kind of considerations if you are going to be structuring a program. So to know this stuff, if you're looking forward and want to make the strongest, most effective program, it would behoove you to have some idea about this. So that's what we say. It's important for STD practitioners, public health officials, to pay attention to what basic science can reveal. Now, these questions are not going to necessarily be answered definitively today. Some aspects all will be addressed. Some will be answered in more definitive ways than others. But we're hoping that this discussion is going to increase the awareness of the importance of these issues and, as I said, facilitate ongoing communication with your basic science colleagues. Thank you.